some of the big contested takeovers. For example, ICI trying to gobble up Courtauld the other way around in the early 60s, or GEC and AEI later in the
70s. No, that wasn't my stocks, unfortunately. I don't believe that. I can't recall.
Yeah.
I can't recall any like that. No.
Did price wars between jobbers ever break out?
Not in the early days, but obviously, but it did in the latter days. We used to sort of make these price agreements, which, well, I'm not sure that any of us agreed with them, because, I mean, if you make a price agreement, it's just so easily broke. But it did happen. There was no animosity between the jobbers on this, nonetheless, you know. I mean, we were still the best of friends. But suddenly, there'd always be somebody who would be sort of breaking the price agreement. By for example, if you're making 3.6, you know, and you could always turn around and say, well, you know, if you want to sell them at 4.5, I'll give you 4.5. But it's so easy to be broken. But it did go on, in some cases, possibly justified, where there was no market turnover. Mm. You know, that was a fair comment, actually. Mm. But I believe that price agreements were really market makers,
yeah.
Unfortunately, but because all it did, in actual fact, was to give business away to other jobbers. I'm not talking about myself particularly, but I'm talking about any of us in price making. If you made 3.6 and you made 1.5, 4.5 over there, he could turn around to him and say, look, that's 3.6, do you want to give me 3?
Mm.
And, you know, it went on.
Were particular firms known for breaking price agreements?
No, I don't think so, no. Mm. No, not particularly one. It was just something that, you know, you broke it that way. It wasn't literally 3.6, 4.5, 7.5 business. It was just a question of what somebody else is making, do you want to deal with me on that price?
Mm.
So it wasn't really, nobody really broke the price agreements.
Mm.
They're pretty honest from that point of view.
Did you find you were doing many joint books with other firms?
Not a lot, no. We had a few. We had a few with Bisgood in the engineering sector. It's not easy. You really, you know, I couldn't figure out how you could run a joint book because your ideas may be different from his,
yeah.
You know, and it just didn't work. But we used to have some joint books where we used to try to make it work. But it really was never on the cards to my mind anyway.
Yeah. What would be the kind of things that could go wrong?
Well, I mean, I might take a view one way and he might take a view another way. Although we do our positions, you know, that was always the same. But if I wanted to deal in 100,000 shares at a price, I'd have to go across to him and see what he thinks about it. He might have said no, or he might have said yes. But there could always been a disagreement in the middle somewhere, you know, especially if the, you know, if there was a disagreement and it went wrong and so forth.
Can you think of any examples?
No, not really.
How would you resolve them? You talked them out between yourselves.
Oh, yes. Oh, they were resolved without any animosity about it.
Yeah.
Yes, there was no arguments or anything like that. It just sorted itself out without any trouble. Anyway, between us, I think Brian Winterflood, you know, we used to do a lot with him actually. We used to firm with Bisgood, and I think possibly we only had them with him. I can't, you know, or Bisgood, not with him, nobody else.
Did put throughs figure much in your experience as a
jobber? Oh, yes, put throughs. There was quite a lot of put throughs being done.
What did you think about these? Because I believe jobbers often felt that the brokers were in fact taking a lot of business out of their hands.
Yes, I think that was possibly so. But the point was, the put-through business always gave you a chance to close your book anyway, if you wanted to. You could always take a certain amount of stock or sell a certain amount of stock, whichever you like.
Mm.
So I don't think it was that bad from a business point of view, because I mean you could always, you could always, providing if the broker himself hasn't checked the put-through price with you, you know, then the broker could be in a lot of trouble because he can lose all his stock or get, you know, one or have to buy all his stock one way. But more often than not, they came to you and asked a put-through basis in a certain number of shares, and you could always tell them and say, look, I would like 25,000 or 50,000 just to close my book, you know, or sell him 50,000 just to level your book up. So I don't think there was any animosity about that sort of business. Everything went off okay, fine.
What about underwriting? Was that something that
Dirlekkers
were involved in, Wed was involved in?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I don't think there was... that used to be done by the, what I call the committee that the Wed used to have. So it really didn't concern you in any way whatsoever, or me, put it, you know, being just a sort of a dealer on the floor of the house. So that there was nothing from that point of view. Mm.
Did you find as time passed that the size of bargains you were doing were increasing? Say, even comparing with the days when you first started as an authorised?
Oh, from when I first started? Oh, yes, definitely from when I first started. But in the latter years, you know, it didn't really. From the first one, when I first started, as I say, you never did big business on the stock exchange, on the market floor. But you did, I suppose it must have got more sizable from the 60s onwards. Because the firms were getting bigger, so therefore you could afford to take bigger positions. There was more cash available to, you could always borrow money from the bank, you know, and so I think from 60 onwards it was getting bigger. And institutions had more money, and as time went on it got bigger and bigger. You know, we used to do a lot of business, but the big business always used to come. I mean, you couldn't blame the broker. If he had ordered a million shares, for example, you couldn't blame him for trying to find a buyer. If you've got a buyer of a million shares, you couldn't blame him for trying to find a seller of a million shares to put the two and two together, because that was his business anyway. And he came in and gave the job at a turn, so that was fair enough. Although, as I say, he could lose it if he's not careful. But I think that's that's the reason why, in the latter years, a lot of the leaks came about because of that. And, I mean, they used to ring up, well, I presume, they used to ring up the, you know, other clients and I want to buy a million, so and so and so and so. And of course, he'd ring up his friend and say, look, you better go and buy yourself 50,000. So the thing was, you know, ruined from the start because the people outside, you couldn't blame them for trying to get in on the bandwagon either.
I suppose we talk about now a lot about things like insider trading and so on. Of course, before the 80s, it wasn't, there was no law against it. But what was your impression about the stock exchange as far as that went? Was there a lot of that kind of thing?
Well, I'm almost sure there was a lot of that kind of thing because, I mean, all the takeovers that came about, I can only remember one in all my life, and that was very early days when Courtauld made a bid for British LNEs. And that really came out of the blue. Nobody had an inkling that anything like that was going on. But in the later years, I mean, everybody knew what everybody else was taking over. But it was never big enough. It was never big in those days, except that one. That was a very, very big one, which went so, well, it came out so peaceful, put it that way, that nobody, you know, everybody was surprised at it, because nobody leaked it. But nowadays, I shouldn't think they can do. You've only got to see a chairman going into another company and somebody's on the phone. And that's how I think they start. But the leaks, there's leaks all over the place now. I presume they were then, actually, insider trading. Somebody knew insider trading just didn't mean takeovers, obviously. It meant if the company's doing well, you know, and the word got around. And so people come in and deal. So, you know, insider trading, it's never been stopped. I personally can't see how they can.
Was there much trading on personal account that went on?
A lot of people. Oh, yes. A lot of, yes, I don't think it matters. I did one myself. in the early 50s, you know, what I call PA dealing. Only one, I only ever did one, because I went away on holiday and came back and lost 100 quid. Well, I could have made 1,000 if I'd have been there, but still, that's 900 there. But it's, oh yes, a lot of, well, without them, your turnover would have been down 50% anyway. I mean, really and truly, they made the market. These, what I call them spiffs, because I mean, that's basically what they were. They're in it for the turn. And if you sold a man 50,000 shares, whatever the stock is, and they went up 2 shillings or 2 and 6, 3 shillings, you can always guarantee that that 50,000 shares is going to come back out again, and you knew where to go and buy them. So, I mean, you know, that was not a bad thing, I don't think. But, well, I don't think it was, because it always, it, personally, I think it increased our turnover by 50%. So nothing, you know, as far as I was concerned, there was nothing detrimental in that whatsoever. We're still done today. But I mean, and that is not insider trading, that's just, well, gambling. You want to back a horse.
So how would, I'm just interested in how it worked in general terms. Would you, you'd sell the stock off your own book?
Oh, yes, I mean, I'd make the same sort of, well, no, I'd make the same sort of price to him as what I make anybody else.
Yeah.
And if the broker comes in and says, what are they? I said, oh, well, 2, 3, so well, I'll buy 50,000 and sell him 50,000.
And how would it work if you wanted to do a deal in your own name? Would you instruct a broker the way a normal client would do?
Well, I wouldn't do it, being a jobber.
Yes.
I would. I never did it being a jobber, because it influences your book, and influences your mind on your book, which I think was would be wrong.
Yeah. But how would a jobber do it if he did?
Well, he'd go to a broker. Yes, he'd get a broker to go and do it for him. But as I say, I never did it. This one I'm telling you about was when I was only a clerk anyway. You know, so that was. I wasn't running a book then. But I never did it in all the years I ran a book. I never dealt PA on my own book, because I think that, as I say, it influences you, and well, you'd never be the same again.
Did you ever feel in the earlier days that there were jobbers who were more interested in looking after their own?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. From what I know and who I knew, I think the answer to that would be no. I don't say they didn't deal in other people's books, you know, or other firms, but I think that's fair enough. But no, they didn't. I would say no. Nobody dealt on their own book. I mean, it happened a few times, once or twice with us, actually. Not through one, but what, late 1970s, yeah, I suppose it might have been. And when they weren't allowed to. And of course, they got pushed out. You know, they were told to go, and no question. No. But I would say it was never ever done. Well, I don't know. I'll say it was never done over the years I've always been there. Certainly not.
Well, we've already talked a little bit about the context that you as a jobber might have with the firms in whose stocks you traded. Did you ever have any contact with the clients outside of the stock exchange?
No. No. No, but not contact as such, but you get to know certain institutions. But I don't think one has with clients. I don't think I very rarely spoke to clients, very rarely spoke to clients. I might have gone to sort of, you know, you go to Hill Samuels or people like that for lunch. And I suppose one might say that they're institutional clients. But I don't think one ever got to them discussing what they want to do or anything like that. At least I didn't anyway. I don't know. I used to just run the book and talk to country brokers and that sort of thing, but never to clients really.
How did things progress now after you became a partner in 1970? Did you you mentioned in 1974 you went onto the gold book for a short time, and then did you more or less stay on the industrial?
I went back to the industrial book and then stayed there until I retired. And as I retired in just before the Big Bang, about 1984. I'd had this trouble, so I decided that, well, I would have stayed there extra 2 years after I was 60, actually, if it hadn't have come up. But as I'd had it long enough, I think I'd had it about 5 years then. So I decided at 60, you know, I was nowhere near well enough to sort of carry on the business. Mm-hmm. So I just went and had the operation and retired from there.
And when was that?
That was in 1984.
Now, how would you contrast the firm of Wed Durlacher in 1984 with the firm of F&N Durlacher, which you had joined in 1938?
Oh, no comparison, no comparison. I mean, Wed Durlacher, how many staff we have? 400 plus. 400 plus partners. 50, 60. Money-wise, millions and millions against a million. No comparison whatsoever. Mm. No comparison whatsoever. Mm. Mind you, I think that was the reason, basically. I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was not so easy today for a person like myself who walked into the city in 1984 and would come out in 2024, like I did walk in 1938 and come out in 1984.
How had the firm coped with all the mergers that had taken place during the period of your career, and there were some very big mergers, like with Wed Jefferson. How did you find these personally? Did you find the character of the firm changed?
No,
much?
I don't think so. No, I mean, I think the two firms, as I say, you know, everybody was on par with everybody else, and we knew everybody else. So there was no bother at all. Everybody just walked in the office one morning and just sat next to each other. Mm. And the whole business went, you know, it carried straight through. Mm. No, I don't think there was any trouble there. I think in actual fact, you know, really truly, it went very, very smooth. Mm. Very smooth indeed. We never had any trouble in any of the takeovers, I think, from when I first started up until the last one of Barclays Bank. There was no, you know, the whole thing was as smooth as it could be. Mm. Really, really, absolutely. Nothing wrong with it. Nobody ever, you know, nobody ever said it shouldn't be, or it should be, or this should have happened, or that should have happened. As far as I knew, the whole business went absolutely very smoothly.
Did you find as time passed that there were fewer jobbers that you were competing against?
Well, yes, because, I mean, as I said, the one-man firm disappeared, and then a lot of mergers took place. And then in the finish, you came down with more or less the three biggest jobbers.
Did that make jobbing any easier?
No.
Did you find it was still very competitive?
Oh, still very competitive. I mean, the biggest competitor, as far as I was concerned, I think, was Smith Brothers. And, you know, I'm very pleased to see that they're carrying on today as a jobber, purely and simply. I mean, no backup behind them, no backup. I mean, they weren't taken over, their name still goes, whereas the name of F&N Durlacher was will disappear.
How did jobbers compete with each other? Did you, for example, know what the other jobber was making in a particular stock?
We didn't bother about it, I don't think. Mm. We had an idea. Because if I'm making 3.6 and he's making 6.9, he would come across and say, look, I'll give you 6. Mm. You see, so you were never far out. But we didn't chase around to see what he was making, or we didn't get people to go around and say, go and find out what he's calling him over there. Because, you know, we all ran our books as we wanted to run them. And as I say, a lot of the time, you see, the price on the board did not necessarily mean you making the price anyway. As I say, you know, it depends. If you want to make 3.6 and 50, and the bloke wants a jillion 200,000, that's an entirely different price. So the board price meant nothing at all.
What was the point of having a board?
Well, because you give them some idea.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of the time, in the later years, people used to put up the 3.6 price, where I used to just put up the middle price. Mm. But it didn't necessarily mean that I'm making it to certain people. If I want to make something else to Tom, Dick or Harry, and different from anybody else. It depended on the way you felt the market was and what you thought his order might be. Mm. You know, if you wanted to try and meet him, which you're entitled to, then you can make the price. If he didn't like it, he'd walk off the pitch. And if he walks off the pit, you know what damn well what he's going to do elsewhere. So, no, it was a good life, absolute fun. Although, it could have been very, well, just serious business, actually, but there was always a lot of play about, you know. It was a fantastic place, and I'm sorry to see it's gone now. No, I could never sit down now and watch that screen day in, day out.
Well, how would you contrast the Stock Exchange as a place to work in when you retired in 84 to when you'd first gone in there as a blue button, as a checking clerk? You were in a different building.
Well, it was in the new building, yes. But there was really no difference. You had your place, you had your spot marked out, you know, which is what you had in the old building when I first started. I don't think there was really no change. The only change was the building, and of course, you know, it got computerized. The waiters had disappeared.
Did the type of people going into the market change? The type of people who were becoming jobbers?
No, I don't know. I don't think so. As I say, most of them came from the right school because, I mean, it was always advertised for people, you know, leaving Oxford and Cambridge. Am I allowed to say that?
Yes, of course.
No, I'm not talking about, I didn't mean it. I mean from me talking about Oxford and Cambridge from where I came from. But I think that most of them, well educated, but that did not necessarily mean you make a decent job. It was a question. Well, I had two people work for me over the years. One, I said to him, well, look, there's no way you'll ever make a job, you know, and but he was a friend of a friend, and I said, you're in the wrong trade. But he always liked to sell cars. So I said, well, why don't you go there? And then one of our partners who got him the job, got him another job, and he's now a director of a big car place up in the West End, you know. So that was right. And another one, who I won't mention the name, he's now one of our biggest gilt dealers. You know, I said to him, I said, you know, you'll go a long way. I sent him home one day because I got very annoyed with him. I got very annoyed with him because he wouldn't do what I wanted him to. And he went home. I sent him home, but he came in the next day. It was all right. But now he's very big.
He had his own views about what he thought the market was going to do. Was this when you were running a pitch by this stage?
Oh, I was running a pitch from before 1970, yes. Oh, yes, I'd run a pitch for quite a few years. I think the last 1960s. I was running my own pitch, middle 1960s.
What was your approach to running a pitch? For example, you mentioned sending the chap home who had different views. Did you feel it was important for you to be in charge?
Well, I think I felt it was important to be in charge because you're making this sort of size what you think is correct, you know. And the youngsters, if they've not been there long enough, it's not easy for them to do it. It's all a question of flair once again. You see, when you can talk to people, and this chap, in actual fact, he was so good at it. Flair, you know, he had the flair, he had the personalities, and he had everything. But I'd still gave him the day off. But after that, we got along terrific. We really did, and we still do. And he'd always talk about it too. He'd talk about that to everybody. But it was one of those things that I may have been a bit upset on the day or something, but still, that's how I felt. And he didn't take no anymore. And he was very good. And he turned out brilliant. Really turned out brilliant.
How did you approach running a pitch? How many dealers do you have working under you?
Well, you only had one. You only had one with you. Sometimes there was two. If we, you know, overstaffed one on a bit of occasion, you had two. But really, there was more or less four of us. There was two there and two here. And we had 150 175 stocks between us. You know, they're about half and we have half. And what we used to do, we used to integrate so that if one was away there, would somebody stand in the middle and that sort of thing. But mostly we had two to run a book, which was enough, because if you have three, then you can never run a book with three. So you have run two, the man in charge and the lad with him. And it worked very well.
How much capital did you feel you needed to run a book?
Well, I don't really know. Very difficult question to answer because at times, I suppose, difficult to say. It varies, I think it varies from 10 to 100 million, I think. And it was always available, there was never any trouble about it. Because most of the time, although you might trade 100 million in a day, the next day it might be down to 50 million by the end of the account. Always by the end of the account, it was always try to get it down to a minimum possible, unless you thought the market was going to take off the following account. Because, you know, it always becomes expensive to borrow money over a period of time. So I really don't know. I would say anything from 10 million to 100 million.
Let me ask you a few more sort of personal questions again. Where were you living during your jobbing career? I assume when you started you were still living at home.
That's right. And then I got married and I was living at Debden, just outside Loughton. And I lived there for 10 years, I suppose, yes, 10 years. Then I moved to where I am now, Waltham Abbey, and I've been there for nearly 30 years.
Did you have any children?
Yes, I had two.
What would you have said to them if they'd asked whether they should go into the city?
Well, I told the boy, I said, if you want to go into the city, I said, you've got to be clever than me. I said, I don't think it would have been right for him to come into the city because being the son of Tommy Anderson, and the name of Tommy Anderson was pretty well known, that's a fact, you know, and I would hate him because he had something there to live up to, and I wasn't sure whether he could do it or not, so I thought it'd be best, you know. I said, you do what you want to do. I said, if you want to go, I said, I'll help you. I said, but you can't expect too much help from me. And I said, because your big reputation that I've got might be difficult for you to beat, you know, and I wouldn't want that hanging over him all the time. So he's done well, he's working for Thorny EMI and he's been there ever since he left school. So, and my daughter's married, so she doesn't have to work. So that's where my two children are. The boy I was mainly concerned about, actually. But as I say, I think you'd be better off if you've, you know, don't go into the city.
How had you met your wife originally? Was she someone who'd been working in the city?
No, just somebody who used to live around locally, which I knew, well, used to lark about with when I was at school, in actual fact. Well, not when I was at school, but soon after I left school. And she was just an ordinary person, like myself.
What would you say the qualities were that you had that had made you a successful jobber?
Well, flair and the gambling instinct. I'm sure the gambling instinct, I'm not quite sure where it came from or what, but I'm sure the flair for, and the interest, you know, as soon as I saw the job, as soon as I got there, I was working for going places, and, well, I don't know really, it's got to be the ambition to be somebody, and think, well, I had an ambition, when I first started, I had an ambition. I thought, well, I've become a dealer, and that's what I'll aim for. And then, of course, when I became a partner, that was beyond my expectations all the way through to my life. I never expected it, not for one minute. Did I expect it at any time, right up until I got the offer. So I put it that flair, interest, not afraid of working. I mean, I used to get in there quarter to 8 in the morning. Never used to start till 8:30 in the office, 9:30 down the market. And leave it 5:30 at night, sometimes you do it 6:30. You know, hard work, absolutely, you know, and not afraid to miss a night out with the boys or anything like that.
Are there any other jobbers who stand out in your memory either as friends or as people who made a big impression on you. You mentioned in the early days Pat Durlacher. Were there any other jobbers who made an impression on you in that way?
I'm afraid I can't remember really. Mm. Not to go back that far.
Well, what about more recent times?
Well, I think Smith Brothers, they always impressed me. And I won't forget any individual, yes. Because I think that all of them were really first-class jobbers, and still are. Mm. You know, even if I've known them for a few years, and they really are fantastic. I think that would be the main firm that I would pick on over the years before Big Bang. They were never afraid to have a go. They were bigger gamblers than me, possibly. But no individual I would pick out there, because I think the firm as a whole are absolutely first class. Mm. All of them.
If someone had asked you during your jobbing career, what you thought were the